Good afternoon. Happy New Year, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. I'm here live in Studio A, and today it's the Midday Health Watch with former Baltimore City Health Commissioner and Washington Post columnist Dr. Lena Wen. Flu cases are up here in Maryland and around the country, and the CDC is reporting more than 2,000 cases of measles in 44 jurisdictions around the country, more cases than at any time in the last 34 years. Yesterday, in an unprecedented move, the CDC also dropped the number of vaccines that it now recommends for children. Last month, Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. announced rules that punish hospitals that offer gender-affirming care for people dealing with gender dysphoria. And President Trump signed an executive order that rescheduled marijuana from a Schedule I drug to a Schedule III drug. In her column in the Washington Post, Dr. Wen wrote about a new study's sobering conclusion about marijuana's effectiveness and safety in some medical treatment. In response to allegations of fraud in daycare centers in Minnesota, HHS announced last week it was freezing grants made available to parents through the Child Care and Development Fund in five states controlled by Democrats. Yesterday, HHS announced it would rescind a series of Biden-era rules around the Child Care Fund, which supports making children and child care more affordable for low-income families. As of last week, Americans in five states who receive SNAP benefits will not be allowed to purchase soda, candy, and other foods with those benefits. As many as 18 states are considering similar restriction. Maryland is not among them. And as we enter the new year, lots of people will be trying to lose weight. And to help with those resolutions, they'll turn to GLP-1 drugs that go by names like Ozempic, Wegovy, and Mounjaro. Researchers have tested these drugs for purposes other than weight loss. Dr. Lena Wen is a former health commissioner of Baltimore, a columnist for The Washington Post, and the author of Lifelines, A Doctor's Journey in the Fight for Public Health. Dr. Wen joins us on Zoom. You are welcome to join us as well. If you have a question about public health matters or your health matters, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Lena, welcome back. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too, Tom. It's always great to talk to you.
So let me ask your opinion about the restrictions for SNAP beneficiaries, folks who get SNAP benefits. There are five states that have now disallowed buying things like soda and candy with SNAP benefits. When you were health commissioner, I remember you made an attempt to have some signage put in stores about the caloric and sugar content and whatnot of sodas in particular, as I recall. But what's, as a public policy move and as a health professional, what's your take on, saying to people with SNAP benefits, there are certain kinds of foods you're not going to be allowed to buy with those benefits?
Well, I think the issue is not easy because on the one hand, no one in public health, no one who is a nutrition scientist would say that soft drinks, candy, chips are good, right? I think that ideally you want a program that is called the supplemental nutrition, that has nutrition in the name in SNAP. You want this program to actually fund and pay for foods that are nutritious. And so I have written in the past about how in my ideal system, in my ideal world, you will have foods that are funded by SNAP, similar to WIC, for women and children, for pregnant women and children. You would want programs like that that maybe are a bit more restrictive in the sense that they do fund or do provide resources only for foods that are that really have nutritious quality. At the same time, you also don't want to introduce regulations that will make obtaining SNAP benefits even more complicated, even more difficult, and then end up having hungry people. And I think that that's the balance that's going to be hard to strike in these states. As a principle, I actually agree with these restrictions that some states are putting in. But I think the practice is going to be where I might get concerned. If the goal is actually to remove people from SNAP, but just by making things too difficult for them.
Yeah, and that's often the case where, an idea is one thing, but the implementation, has some sometimes unintended consequences. Let me ask you about the flu. NPR just reported before our show started today about the big uptick in flu cases all over the country. Maryland is one of the places where there's a big surge in flu cases. Is it too late for people to get a flu shot? Is there any particular reason that you can identify that there are more flu cases this year than in years past?
Well, we saw this happening in other countries before the US. We saw an uptick in cases, probably driven by a different variant of the flu, H3N2. It seems to be the dominant variant here in the US and in some other countries as well. It may just be as a result of this new variant that we have that we're getting more cases. But to directly answer your question, Tom, about whether it's too late, it is not too late to get the flu vaccine. In fact, now is a good time to get it because even though cases are surging, we anticipate that the cases have not reached their peak yet. And so, of course, ideally, people should get their flu shot by late October so that they're well protected throughout the entire flu season. But it's not too late to get it now. You will, if you get it today, you'll still be protected, ideally for the peak of flu season. And again, I think it's important to remember why we get the flu vaccine, why we get the COVID vaccine. The main reason for doing so is to reduce the likelihood of severe disease. So even if you do contract the flu, you will decrease your chance if you're vaccinated, of getting hospitalized and of dying.
And peak flu season is when, generally speaking?
Well, it should be now. But based on the numbers that the CDC is seeing in terms of infections and hospitalizations, we know that hospitalizations, for instance, is a lagging indicator, meaning that people get sick first, then they get hospitalized, then the numbers are reported. So we anticipate that that might be in the next few weeks, maybe even into February. And so again, that's one more reason why getting the flu vaccine now is better than not getting it at all. And I think there's also this misconception that some people have about how, well, only vulnerable people get very ill from the flu. It is true, of course, that older individuals, immunocompromised individuals, people with chronic medical conditions are more likely to get severely ill. But even young, healthy individuals can become very ill too. And so, getting vaccinated is what major medical societies continue to recommend.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is my guest. It's the Midday Health Watch. I'm Tom Hall. If you'd like to join us, our number here, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. So, Lena, I want to ask you about measles as well, and in conjunction with the new CDC recommendations about childhood vaccines. Helen Branswell, who's one of the great health reporters, of long standing, reports that in 2025 there were more than 2,000 cases here in the United States, and that is also the case. There's a big uptick in measles cases in a number of other developed countries as well. We are close to losing our designation as having eradicated measles because there's such an upsurge of them. But measles, I mean, we had hundreds of children being quarantined in South Carolina, and some other states have had really serious problems with measles outbreaks. Measles is a very serious disease, isn't it?
Yes, and I think that there's all this discussion about vaccines and whether they're safe. For the record, vaccines are safe. There have been many randomized controlled trials indicating that's the case. But I think people have been neglecting to talk about how dangerous the diseases are that these vaccines are supposed to prevent. And you think about something like measles that virtually every child in the US used to get. Now, many people will recover without incidence from measles, and for many people, it will be not unlike a bad flu. But measles can be very serious. We're talking about a disease that can cause brain damage, that can cause severe pneumonia, that can also lead to death and has led to death in the past in a very contagious illness that's so contagious that 9 out of 10 unvaccinated people, if exposed, will contract it. And so I think it's extremely unfortunate that we're in this position of having outbreaks again after successfully having eliminated this disease in 2000, more than 20 years ago, more than 25 years ago. And of course, I fear, and I think we're going to see an increased number of outbreaks, given the decreasing number of people who are getting the measles, mumps, and rubella, the MMR vaccine.
We have a question about the flu vaccine from Margaret, who sends us an email. It says, I'm in my late 70s and had a flu shot in November, and I've read conflicting information about the effectiveness of the shot. Is another version of the shot in the works? Because, Lena, we've talked many times about how folks at the beginning of flu season have to kind of speculate about what the strain of the flu virus is going to be, and formulate a vaccine that, you know, would meet the requirements for that particular strain. But there's a strain this year that is it in some ways resistant to the vaccine that's been developed for this particular year?
It's a bit hard to say. I think signs are pointing to that perhaps the vaccine that's developed is less effective against this new strain. And as you said, Tom, it's a bit of a guessing game. You need to get the vaccine composition as close as possible, but you don't really know. But you have to get it ahead of this flu season, because you have to produce enough vaccines to get them into arms before the flu season, before you actually know what the strain that's going to be dominant is. And so there is not going to be another version of the vaccine available this season. There will be next year, or next season, meaning for the 2026-2027 season, but not in time for this flu season now. There was a study done in the United Kingdom that found that the flu vaccine there did appear to work against the H3N2 a strain that's dominant, but that strain, the vaccine in the UK had a slightly different composition compared to the one in the US, so I'm not sure that we can directly compare. But I think the moral of the story here is, even if the vaccine is not that effective at preventing infection with this new strain, it still should reduce your chance of getting severely ill. And ultimately, that is the outcome that we want to prevent the most.
And let's talk about what the CDC announced just yesterday about the change to the vaccine schedule for children. The reports about this in all of the accounts that I've read, you know, call this an unprecedented change. Can you explain what they're now saying and how that differs from what, you know, has been the case, what the CDC has been recommending for decades?
That's right. Well, for decades, the CDC has had a very carefully established process for determining which are the childhood vaccines that are recommended, at what interval, how many doses are recommended, and so forth. This was something that was not just arbitrary. It was something that took a lot of research, a lot of consideration of the practicalities, and also of translating the evidence into policy. So how do you translate a paper showing effectiveness into policy that would affect the population? And there was a whole process for doing that. Well, here's the thing, the science has not changed. And so it's not as if there's new research coming out saying that, oh, we actually need fewer vaccines, or that some of these diseases no longer exist. The science and the realities of these diseases haven't changed. If anything, we are seeing a resurgence of diseases. You mentioned measles, Tom, but also we're seeing a resurgence of tetanus. We're seeing a resurgence of whooping cough, among others. If anything, we want more protection and not less. And usually there is or in the past, there has always been a process whereby the advisors to the CDC meet, there's a very careful consideration, and then there's a decision made. Well, this appears to be a unilateral decision made by Secretary Kennedy to essentially cut the recommended number of childhood vaccines against 17 diseases, which is what it has been for a long time, to only 11 diseases. And the things that they're no longer recommending as a blanket recommendation include illnesses like meningitis and hepatitis and the flu. And I guess the question that many people have, including me, would have is, well, why are we doing this? In fact, we're in the middle of a resurgence of many of these. We just talked about how we're in the midst of a bad flu season. Why on earth, in the absence of science having changed or the reality of these diseases having changed, are we making are we making this kind of very significant cutback in vaccine recommendations that will surely have an impact on vaccine confidence, on public trust, and also on who ends up wanting access to vaccines, but who's not able to get it.
Yeah, and again, Helen Braswell, who we were talking about a minute ago, who's a health reporter for Stat, reports that of the 2,000 plus measles cases in the United States in 2025, 93% of the people who contracted measles were unvaccinated. So there just simply does seem to be you don't have to be a scientist to figure out that there's a connection there. But when we're talking about hepatitis A and B, meningitis, rotavirus, the other diseases that are no longer on this list from the CDC. I mean, some of the risk-reward calculation, which, obviously needs to be made with your physician, it's interesting that the language that the CDC uses to make these announcements says, families should consult with their physicians about these other diseases and the vaccines for these other diseases, almost as if that's some new concept. I mean, people consult with their physicians all the time to get all of the vaccines that are recommended and have been recommended for years by the CDC. What do you make of this kind of emphasis on consultation with a physician before you make the move to go ahead and vaccinate your children?
Well, I don't think anyone would disagree with the idea that you should consult with your physician. But that's, as you said, Tom, that's what's always been done. I think that the change, though, is really important because it creates confusion. It also could make other issues, including insurance coverage, and the willingness of vaccine manufacturers to even continue making these vaccines, it throws all those things into question. And yes, the federal government is saying, well, insurance is still going to be covered, but I'm not sure how we could know that, especially since insurance coverage in many cases are tied to recommendations from the CDC. And so I think we now have a situation where the federal government is going to be saying one thing. We'll have states, including states like Maryland, saying another, and medical organizations also openly in disagreement with federal government recommendations. And I think we really need to have state health officials and medical organizations stand up and do what's right. But at the same time, we have to acknowledge that that only creates confusion.
Absolutely. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to get ourselves in trouble because we're going to talk about medical marijuana, which is always a controversial topic when we chat about it here on the Midday Health Watch. Dr. Lena Wen is our guest. She's a former health commissioner of Baltimore. She's a columnist on health matters for the Washington Post. She's a medical expert at CNN and a scholar at George Washington University and the Brookings Institution. To join our conversation after a quick break, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to 88.1 WYPR, your local NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the show, it's Midday for Word Nerds. My guest will be the author and journalist Stefan Fatsis. He's written a wonderful, funny, fascinating book called Unabridged, The Thrill of and Threat to the Modern Dictionary. He embedded himself with the staff at the Merriam-Webster Dictionary to find out what goes in to the creation of definitions and the choice of the words they define. So Stefan Fatsis will join me to talk about it tomorrow on Midday. And if you just joined us today, it's the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Nguyen. Dr. Nguyen is a former health commissioner for Baltimore City, a columnist for The Washington Post, a medical expert at CNN, and a scholar at George Washington University and the Brookings Institution. She's on Zoom. You can join us on the phone at 410-662-8780 or on email midday@wypr.org. So, Lena, you wrote a piece in The Washington Post about a recent study having to do with medical marijuana and how medical organizations are weighing in on its utility and, again, the risk-reward, the harm versus benefit calculation. What did they find and what did you write about?
Well, I wanted to tackle this issue of medical marijuana because, frankly, I'm in Maryland and D.C. around our area. You can walk around and see a lot of different advertisements that promote cannabis as kind of an all-around wellness tool. You see cannabis being promoted as a treatment for conditions from chronic pain to anxiety to dementia to glaucoma to a lot of things. And there are surveys showing that as many as one in four adults in America and Canada have tried cannabis for medical purposes. But then the question is, well, is this supported by evidence? So I was really intrigued by a new study that was published in JAMA that looked at every high-quality study from the last 15 years that they could find, and they also examined guidelines from major medical societies to see what is it that medical societies recommend and what do these studies actually show in terms of what are the medical benefits of cannabis. And the conclusion was actually surprising, I think, what will be surprising to a lot of people, which is that for most of these indications that people think cannabis is useful for, the evidence is very limited or inconclusive. And in many of these cases, medical organizations actually recommend against using cannabis because while there is limited benefit or limited evidence for potential benefits, the evidence for harm is actually quite clear. And so I think one thing that that's important for listeners to know and that the paper was careful to distinguish is between cannabinoids, which are the compounds that are isolated from cannabis, and cannabis itself, which is the cannabis plant. For cannabinoids, there are uses that are approved by the FDA, for example, for advanced HIV, for severe seizures, patients on chemotherapy who have no appetite. I mean, there are very specific cases like that. But when it comes to cannabis plant, many of the indications that we usually think about, like pain, rigorous studies have not shown clear benefit for it. Or some people use cannabis to self-treat anxiety, depression, or post-traumatic stress disorder. But actually, large randomized controlled studies have not found evidence of benefit. And in fact, have found that using cannabis as self-treatment for mental health issues may worsen or trigger problems like psychosis and increased suicide risk. And I'll just add here, too, that I think some people think that because cannabis has medical purposes, that it has no harm. And that is something we really need to educate people about because there is harm. There's because it impairs judgment and coordination. There's an increased rate of motor vehicle accidents and fatalities when using cannabis. Regular use is also associated with the risk of cannabis use disorder and affecting as many as 30% of regular users. Itself is an addiction that's marked by cravings, withdrawal symptoms. And I think that the concern here is, you know, I certainly do not think that we should be criminalizing cannabis. And I actually think that doing more research on the medical indications of cannabis and cannabinoids very much is needed because maybe there are new medical indications that we have not even seen yet. I want rigorous research into this. But what I fear is that people are misunderstanding that cannabis has medical uses. Maybe it does have medical uses in very specific cases, or certainly cannabinoids could, but that does not mean that this is a compound that's harmless. And in fact, it itself is an addictive drug with a real risk of harm.
What do you think of the decision to reclassify marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3 There are those in support of this decision by President Trump who say, for example, that it will make research that you're talking about easier and more prolific because as a Schedule III drug, it's going to be easier for people to look into it. Do you buy that argument?
Well, I hope that they're right, because the other thing that you need in order for research to happen is funding. And currently, these cannabis dispensaries and the cannabis industry really does not have an incentive to study medical indications because they're allowed to advertise for medical indications. What is in it for them to do rigorous studies that actually prove them wrong? And so who is going to be funding these studies? Right now, we're seeing cutbacks in scientific research. And look, I want more research. Can reclassification make it easier to study? Sure, but you also need the funding. And I just don't know how that funding is going to come about. And also, what are the incentives for these companies to compel them to want to study this issue? And so I worry that reclassification might further increase access to cannabis. And again, I'm not opposed to the reclassification. I just think that it needs to come with numerous things, including a commitment for rigorous study, no matter what the findings are, as well as public education on the harms of cannabis use.
Let's take a call about cannabis. Let's go to David, who's on the line in Baltimore. Welcome to the program with Dr. Nguyen.
Hi, Dr. Nguyen. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for taking our call, Tom. A couple of things. One, Dr. Nguyen, you mentioned a couple of times about cannabis companies advertising various health and wellness effects. One important thing is that cannabis companies in Maryland are not allowed to advertise, which ultimately obviously hurts businesses because they're not able to advertise for their actual business. But two, there are actually a lot of studies conducted by outside researchers, by scientific advisory boards, by various universities, and by the cannabis companies themselves to ensure that the products that they are creating are actually beneficial to their customers. You mentioned what would the incentive be? The incentive would be to continue to be able to help the patients throughout Maryland, whether that's to not be addicted to opioids or to help with PTSD, or whether it's a Crohn's disease medication. There are lots of things that patients have been able to find relief from.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, David. And, you know, Lena, there's, of course, a distinction between recreational use of marijuana as well as medical use. But what's your response to David's perspective?
I think this is why I really appreciated the JAMA study. I was not involved in the study in any way. I did not know the authors other than as someone who interviewed them after they wrote the article. I have not done this kind of comprehensive review myself, right, of all the articles that have been written. Again, there have been a number of articles, including the ones that the caller referenced. But what these authors did in this JAMA review is to look at basically every study they could find on the medical uses of cannabis. They evaluated it using a rigorous methodology to see is it of sufficiently high quality to be included in their study. And what they found, again, is that while there may be case reports, while there may be individuals who say they benefited in some way, while there may be small studies perhaps that are of lower quality that may have shown benefits, that when you look at in aggregate these studies, that the evidence is limited or inconclusive for medical uses of cannabis. Now, again, not for the cannabinoids that are approved as the compounds for specific treatments, but for cannabis, the plant. And so, look, I would never deny the experiences of individuals. If there are individuals that, as David is referencing, who have found relief for certain conditions, look, I think that's something that they should discuss with their clinicians, and they should continue with what works for them. My concern is twofold. One is I get worried when people are self-treating and not getting the treatment that is evidence-based. So, for example, if somebody is saying, I'm going to be treating my depression with cannabis or my post-traumatic stress with cannabis and not getting evidence-based treatments that may actually be helping them, I get worried about that. The same thing for Crohn's disease or any number of other things. So I definitely don't think cannabis should be understood as a first-line treatment when evidence-based first-line treatments exist for these conditions. The second issue that I'm worried about is, again, when we talk about medical marijuana, again, I do not deny that some patients may really benefit from medical indications, even if the evidence on a population level is not there. But I do not want that to be conflated with thinking that, well, just because it's got medical uses means that it does not have any harm and that it's good for me. Cannabis is not good for you. It's not a wellness product that is just something that you should do. It's not like water. You should be drinking water. You should be taking cannabis. I think we should be reframing cannabis to be something more like alcohol or tobacco, that it is an addictive drug with real risk of harm.
All right, well, thanks for that call, David. I appreciate it. Let's go back to the phones to Essex. Italio is on the line. Welcome to the show with Dr. Lena Wynn.
1.2.
Hi, Italio. What's up?
Yes, hi. My name is Vitellio. I'm calling from Essex, and I just wanted to express a concern about some of Dr. Wynn's statements earlier on the infectious diseases, measles, and what's not. I'm just really concerned. I'm not from this country. I'm not going to be here another year or two. And I'm concerned about really data because this present administration has kind of shown a penchant for dismissing data that's adverse. So when Ms. Wynn talks about 2,000 new measles cases or whatever, it could be 4,000 because not just in infections, but in every aspect of our lives, they dismiss or they fire people who just talk about the real data or what's happening. So I'm concerned next pandemic, as the numbers are coming in, we're not going to get the information because the data or the research that's not favorable is being obscured. So how do I know that either be it measles or whatever COVID or the flu cases, if that is the actual data? I know Johns Hopkins used to publish data about COVID, but even universities are scared to do anything that's adverse to this present administration. So how do we know? How do we know that what we're being told does reflect the actual true
Right.
data?
Well, thank you, Italia. That's a good question. And I was referencing the measles number to Helen Branswell, who's a health reporter for Stat News, which is a big, very credible health publication. But Lena, you and I have talked about this before. It's difficult to discern sometimes what's going on when we have data coming from the government that a lot of people have, pretty good reason for doubting. I mean, we see this in the Labor Department where they fired all of the folks who were, giving the unemployment numbers. It's not just the CDC. You've talked before in other shows about advice to pay attention in particular to what medical organizations are saying.
Yes, and I share the concern that the gentleman just raised. I too worry about lack of data. We have talked about this before in reference to COVID, but just because you don't know about the cases, or just because these cases are not reported, doesn't mean that they aren't there. And the last thing that we would want is for infectious diseases to be spreading, and for us to not know about it until it's not just a small outbreak, but a large one affecting multiple states. And I am worried about this. I think that this administration, they're already signaling that they want to reduce reporting on vaccine coverage. With the cutbacks in staff also at the CDC, at the FDA, at other places, I do worry too about capacity and whether there will be enough people even to be making these reports. Look, I think there is reason to doubt, especially going forward, the data coming out from our federal health officials, and it makes me very anxious and very upset to be even saying this. But to your point, Tom, I think it really underscores the importance of having medical organizations step up and issue recommendations. Also, states that have access to their own data sources. I understand that some states, including Maryland, are working together in collaboratives to pool their data so that even if there aren't reliable federal data in the future, at least there could still be reliable statewide data. Again, that's not the best way to do things because not all states are going to participate in this collaborative. And frankly, this is what the CDC has always done. The CDC has been that central repository where you could look at and say, this is what's happening on a national level because we know that infectious diseases do not cross borders. But I think what's going to end up happening is this much more fragmented system where states will have different rules regarding vaccinations and different reporting mechanisms regarding infectious diseases.
Unfortunately, we are almost out of time. I do want to give you a chance to give us some good news having to do with testing for cervical cancer. So in our last 30 seconds, Dr. Nguyen, what can you tell us about that?
Well, the American Cancer Society has changed their cervical cancer screening recommendations significantly because for the first time, women have the option to collect their own sample at home rather than requiring a clinician-performed exam. And so it's important to note that the preferred screening option is still a sample collected by the healthcare provider, but self-collected testing for HPV, which is the virus that causes the majority of cervical cancer cases, is now offered as an option. And so I think it's always good to have more options rather than less that help to decrease the barrier to cancer screening.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is a former health commissioner of Baltimore and a columnist for The Washington Post. Her latest book is terrific. It's called Lifelines, A Doctor's Journey in the Fight for Public Health. Lena, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And I hope we have a chance to do this again next month. I think we will.
I hope so as well. Thank you so much, Tom.
And up next, the author Marion Winnick will talk about her new memoir, First Comes Love. Marion will join me after a quick break. But before we go to that break, it's our practice here on Midday to read the names of people who've lost their lives to violence in Baltimore City and to list their names on the Midday webpage. We get their names from a researcher named Ellen Worthing from the Baltimore Sun and from the Baltimore Police Department. In 2019, our city recorded 352 homicides. In 2025, there were 133 murders in Baltimore. That's a lot of people who lost their lives, but it's many, many fewer than we have in recent years become accustomed to. It's 61 fewer homicides than our city experienced in 2024, which itself was 62 fewer deaths than in the year before, 2023. It's the lowest number of homicides in Baltimore in more than 50 years. And here on Midday, we acknowledge those who've had their lives taken to stand in witness to their untimely deaths and to remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. Police have identified 12 of the 13 people who were killed in Baltimore in the last 3 weeks of December. They are Leroy Alexander, age 56, Erica Power, age 42, Keon Smith, age 28, Daquan Parker, age 26, Davon Smallwood, age 19, Nathaniel Tarleton, age 29, Michael Hitchens III, age 14, Chanel Cawthorn, age 50, Erica Sterling, age 54, Dewan Hawkins, age 43, Ronnie Burston, age 51, and Charles Brothers. He was 32 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
You're listening to 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.